Well, my name is Kea Foisia. My maiden name was Mamoli. And actually, I arrived in California in 1964 because my father was in the Navy. But prior to that, we lived in Honolulu or Hawaii. I was raised there up to age 14. And then we lived in San Diego. My father was stationed there. And then when he retired, we found a home here in Carson.
Your father was in the Navy, too?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. Where were you born?
I was born in Fangapango, American Samoa, in 1949. And then from there, the U.S. Military, we traveled on a ship to Hawaii, another territory, and we lived there for a while.
Do you know why your family came to Carson to live?
Mostly because of relatives that were already here and the fact that it's always near the ocean or where we can obtain our kind of food, fish, and my father liked it here.
Yeah. What high school did you go to?
Well, I attended Notre Dame Prep. It was a private school. At one time, I had the intention of becoming a nun or a sister, school sister of Notre Dame, and that was called an aspirature, and that I boarded there for about 3 years in Sunland, Tahunga, near Glendale, uh-huh. You know, about 60 miles away. And then after I graduated from there, I tried to, you know, go back to Harbor College and get some classes. And eventually I found a job at the City Hall, Carson City Hall, and stayed there for over 20 years.
What do you do there?
Oh, I just do general office work, uh-huh. Payroll for our maintenance department.
I see. So when you, I've asked them the same question, when you first came here, what most struck you about Southern California?
Well, in Hawaii, it's a melting pot, so we were used to the different cultures. But just like Liz said, it was terrible because we had a fear already of the civil rights movement. So by the time we arrived in 64, things were already heavy. And, of course, it was the black situation that we were going to be treated, you know, just as bad. Mm-hmm. So upon arrival, that's what we were looking at. We could not get over, you know, the many blacks that were already here. We were used to the other cultures, Asian and Polynesian, but and then the way we were treated also is that they didn't understand who we were, you know. But it was mostly understanding the black movement, and of course, the year after that in '65 was the Watts riot, and by that time there was a lot of fear that you know, that things were going to get even worse, and unfortunately, it's not, you know, quite better now.
I actually want to ask you about that, what that was like for, and you came sort of at the tail end of that, but what it was like being in Southern California during the civil rights movement, during Vietnam. Mm-hmm.
At that time, I was a teenager, and our first fear was that we went through Anaheim and Long Beach, where it started to have trouble there, but watching it on TV and the Burn Baby Burn, you know, issue or model that they made, it was horrifying for all of us. We were afraid that we were going to be in the middle of it also because of the color of our skin, but it was just a lot of injustice. And as the years went on, we just felt like we were part of that, or just on the tail end, that we were always going to be mistreated the same manner. So in a way, we adopted some of that black movement, you know, to have better treatment for everybody here in the United States. Hawaii was a little different. Everybody accepted each other, and I believe a lot of the blacks enjoyed living in Hawaii. But we watched it on TV for several days, and we were afraid that it was going to come down to our area, you know, eventually.
That's right, because those guys there started something, didn't you, Jimmy?
No, I didn't start anything.
Oh, yes, you did.
But as far as the riots, I was in Germany at the time, so I was pretty well removed from it.
Mm-hmm. What was Liz just referring to?
Well, the organization that you guys started up. You know, it was something I believe that came
Fantastic.
Out of, yes.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
it's
it was an awareness.
Kind of like a spin-off of the civil rights type mm-hmm. black movement. And this was geared mostly to Samoans, trying to get our piece of the pie, but, mm-hmm. you know.
Mm-hmm. What year did you start it?
That was late 60s, because mm-hmm. I was just out of the military then. Mm-hmm. So it was after 66.
And it was an organization or just a
yeah,
movement?
It was an organization. Mm-hmm. Is it in the book there?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's in that book.
Is there a movie made about that?
No.
I believe there was a video.
Yeah,
I think Simi.
Yes,
Simi
did it.
By, was ADAP the one Asian American Drug Abuse Program.
Yeah, I hear it's very good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, Simi, the one that was really into that, is their cousin.
Could you tell me more about it? About the organization? Why you started it and who started it?
You'd probably be better at that because your husband was really involved into it. My brother was, he was kind of right in the middle of things. Mm-hmm. I just came along as his brother.
It was a search for identity, for our own people. A lot of our kids began to realize that we didn't know too much of our culture. And so they began as a social club with USO, United Samoan Organization. And that was just to gather them together and have dances and, express themselves like the blacks were doing and the Mexicans or Hispanics. And eventually it wasn't enough because we just felt that a lot of the kids hadn't found themselves through the education process and we were being neglected or ignored. So, of course, the education thing came across and that we needed to tutor a lot of our kids to stay in school. And that's where it started to move in that direction. And that's when he came in and became more involved. But USO was a social club. It was Omai Fatasi that some people labeled as radical, too extreme for a lot of our older parents or the elders, the community. Yeah. And it was there to help the children that were coming from the islands into the mainstream here and identifying that it's okay to be who we are, and express ourselves. But to this day, they've identified too much with the gangbanging of Hispanics and the black movement, rather than addressing our own culture. But Omai Fatasi was the stepping stone, and unfortunately, we should have carried it further. But a lot of us had to go on for our own lives and search, jobs.
And everybody got.
Yeah, so we're looking to our other generation to, move into now. It seems to be politics. Mm-hmm. That's the main thing now.
Yeah, Omai Fatasi means come together. So, I guess that's why they decided on that name.
What would be an example of the type of thing you did that made some of the other people think that you were a more radical arm?
I think it was the manner of dress. We had Afro hairdos, and then that was a part of the expression. But again, it was the hippie movements, so that type of thing. And also we began to read a little bit about Karl Marx. What's the other one that just died? It's a shame. Malcolm X. I'm sorry. That was a big thing. Some of the children were believing in that philosophy. And, of course, it was a struggle between what Martin Luther King, thought. It was a shame because we had to look to them for that type of identity and third world activities that were going on.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then finally you said, education is the key, and then we have to educate our parents also to understand us. It's not right to protest or demonstrate.
Mm-hmm. So
at that time,
you would get together. What types of activities? Would you do these readings together?
A couple of times.
Yeah, I did that.
Mm-hmm.
Little red books.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I skipped out.
That's when his brother too said it's not good to fight against the system. We better work within to make the change. Mm-hmm. Find something that we believe in and adopting some of those principles.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, then we get some of those radical ideas, like burning the city down.
It was getting too violent.
That was just just talking about these things.
Yeah.
I said, "Jeez,
nope,
this isn't for me."
Just sort of like when you used to skip out from the services.
Yeah,
that's right.
That's
him.
Got to move on.
Can you guys talk about your sort of high school, teenage years, what types of things you were involved in then, or activities or places you used to go to?
Well, my high school years, just school and playing football.
Oh, you played football?
Yeah, but originally I had signed up to play baseball because at that time I didn't know what football was in the early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So I had gone in and I was going to sign up for the baseball team. And the coach took one look at me and says, no, you don't want to play baseball. You go and see this coach. So I went to see them, and that's when I found out what I was signed up for was football. I knew nothing about football. I didn't even know what it was. Didn't even know the rules. So my whole 10th grade year was finding out what this game's all about.
What was the first practice like?
Oh, it was... The first practice, I was in a daze because there were people yelling at you, and I would compare that first day to my first day in the military. It was no different, you know. People were screaming at you, pushing you, and gosh, after the first day, I didn't know what I was doing there. I didn't even know what this game was about.
What position did they think you played?
I thought I was a tapping dummy for a while because they just stick you up in front and they tell you the guy with the ball, you go for him, but they didn't tell you all these other guys would be trying to knock you out of the way.
So how long did you say you played football through high school though?
Right, for Benny High School.
Did you enjoy it eventually?
Yeah, eventually it got to be fun. But my understanding of the game was still very limited. And I think the only reason why they put me there was because of my size. Mm-hmm. You know, I told them I didn't know what football was, but they didn't care. They said, it's all right, you'll learn. And eventually I did learn.
Gosh.
And by the time my brothers came after me, they knew exactly what football was. They didn't have all this other... What shock as far as the game or anything. They were well-versed in football by the time they got in, and they did quite well. I was quite surprised.
What types of things were you involved in?
Well, during high school, like, I was in a boarding school, convent type school, so I was very disciplined and uniform, and I was used to that. But when I would come home on the weekends, that was chaos. My brothers were attending Banning and public school, and it's a whole new world. It's a little frightening. We had the Hispanics or the Vato girls that had their hair all made up, teased, and a lot of heavy makeup. So I just felt out of place. And I said, I guess I represent the good side in life. I don't know, the religious side. And everything was like, my brothers would look at me, but I was the one that was irregular in the whole scene. And I enjoyed going to the football games, but the crowds were a little too noisy, and it scared me. And my brothers, they really, that was it. Football was where they could get in there and hit everybody up, take their frustration out. It was like, you know, it was a masculine thing. And the dances, I didn't like to go out to dances. I was a little bit nervous to be around crowds because of the type of school I went to. But it was, it was good to understand both sides of the world.
Yeah.
And eventually I came out of it anyway and jumped in. Yeah, no regrets, though. It's good to learn both sides.
Sure.
You know, but through the whole thing, I think we enjoyed being together. I got to know more of my own people, our own. And we all would go congregate at a place called Scott Park, which became infamous for volleyball games. He said, teaching the kids. He paved the way, the older ones, for all the games, you know, to come out. And we felt free to be among ourselves and express ourselves through sports. And that's when also picnics and things like that, and getting to talk together and understand what our identity is, you know, and teach the others. But it was mostly that type of thing. But we felt better being together, and that's why all the groups, would come at one particular park, which was, you know, Scott Park.
Where's that located?
Right here at Catskill in Carson, city of Carson.
It's still there. Mm-hmm.
Still there.
Yeah. Were there other places where you would hang out as teenagers, or that was popular among?
Not as an ethnic group, but you know, just as high school students.
Mm-hmm.
There were, on Pacific Coast Highway, there were a lot of fast food places.
Uh-huh.
Used to hang out there.
What's that place you guys used to go dance at? Was it Will Hall or something?
Oh, yeah.
VFW Hall? I don't know.
Will Hall, you guys
used to in Wilmington. That's
right. Wilmington.
What's that?
Wilmington Hall. That's another gym, another park that we would all have games there. And then we identified by going to Filipino Hall, where we had dances.
Yes.
Those were open to us. The VFW Hall. And later on, even the nightclubs or restaurants. There used to be Latitude 20, Mr. C's in Long Beach, those kind of clubs that we would frequent. But again, it was We didn't go out of our area, really.
No.
Yeah. 7C is Hollywood.
For Madame Wong's.
Madame Wong's in Chinatown. We enjoyed going. Oh, another thing they loved was to see the martial art movies on Sundays in Chinatown.
Loved it.
Yeah. They would get a car full of guys to go and watch, what's that, Satriwichi and all that.
Satriwichi.
Bruce Lee movies, they were all
into. Samurai movies were a favorite.
Mm-hmm.
Is that Chinatown in Long Beach?
No, it was Los Angeles.
You go
all the way
up there for that?
They used to have a place called Toho La Brea Theater. I don't think it's there anymore.
No.
No, I mean,
that was in Chinatown?
No, that's...
Is it downtown Little Tokyo?
It's downtown... It's on La Brea.
Oh, okay. Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
And then...
it's sort of Crenshaw area.
Well, the Crenshaw area, that would be Kokusai. Kokusai was the theater there in the Crenshaw area. Yeah, we used to do that.
That was in the 60s?
Yeah.
How did you find out about those places?
Well, I'd drive around.
But I think it is the older group. Like, he was the one, it was his interest that everyone followed. And that's amazing because he also is a brown belt judo. He'd been to Japan. So whatever his interests are, everybody would, you know.
I used to take my brothers to the movies with me.
Uh-huh.
Even his music.
Uh-huh.
He would buy all these music. I mean, I wasn't here at the time, but I hear from Kia here and other members of the family, oh yeah, Jeannie always used to have this music. Everybody used to go and steal it from him and play when he's not there.
I don't have any music anymore because my brothers would take all the LPs and they'd go to parties. And
what was the kind of music you guys would...
Well, at that time, it was rhythm and blues. You know, Motown was just, you know, come along.
But they love Sergio Mendes and Brazil something.
But Brazil 66 at that time.
He set the pace, more or less, of what their interests were. It broadened it, you know.
Because they were my little brothers.
So. Socially.
Did you know him when you were in high school?
No. My cousins all knew him.
See, because she was in boarding school now, remember?
But my cousins always come back and hear about him, the most eligible bachelor.
Way back.
But he was the one, him and some of the older guys that used to hang around, some are gone now. But they were the ones who had
his group.
Because they had the job and the money, the prestige and status. So everyone said, oh, when I get there, that's it. So they enjoyed being with him and, of course, looked up to him for that judo brown belt thing. Because we couldn't afford some of that martial arts, you know, to go there. So everybody, he would look to people like, you know, him. I don't mean people like him. But, you know, that they were...
I had the job. My brothers would drive the car and... Mm-hmm. I usually made the payments. And in fact, at one time, my monthly gas bill was more than the monthly payment on the car.
Oh,
God. Because it was me, there's Harry, there's Wilson, and James. There was four of us driving my one car.
What kind of car did you have?
At that time, I had a Oldsmobile 442 gold.
Mm-hmm. Always gold and black.
Yeah.
Black top.
So that car never rested because between, but they were pretty good. They knew when I had to go to work, so the car would be home for me to go to work. But other than that, sometimes I'd wake up in the morning, look out the window, and the car's gone. So who's ever the first one out gets the keys, and he's gone.
Oh, boy. So when did you get to know the Poicea family?
Actually, the parents, they all knew each other back home, and then... I believe his father and my father were in the Fita Fita Navy, and so we knew about each other more or less through families. But it just happened growing up and going to school, and my brothers knew, you know, his brother, I mean, a couple of them, and that's how we all got together. But it's always the family thing where our parents would say, well, whose kid are you? Who's your mother? Who's your father? And then, oh, you're related, you know, so that's how we always had to be careful about that.
Yeah.
But it all happened, you know, through the parents and eventually getting to meet everybody, the generation, you know, later. Yeah.
How did you meet your husband?
Oh, that was, again, he was a friend of my brother's, and so it was just, it was funny because we know of the families, but then just later on you find out, well, I'm so-and-so's, you know, son, and then we just, like, socially met. Mm-hmm.
Was that in the 60s or 70s?
Yeah, 60s.
And then you got married in the
70s. Uh-huh.
Okay. Let's see. So now, today, what sorts of organizations or cultural activities do you find yourself involved in or that are important to you and your family?
I think the number one thing we would say is politics. Mm-hmm. Well, 20 years later?
Yes.
Something that we try to do and we wish we had carried a little bit stronger. But Liz here is very active in many community activities. But I think it's the power of politics.
Power of the vote.
Power of the vote. And that way we can get our message across to the upcoming youth, mm-hmm. that they need to learn from what we should have carried through stronger, but we had to go out and deal and make a living.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
we took a sabbatical. From Omai Fatasi to now, it's been a long sabbatical.
Does Omai Fatasi still exist?
No, but a lot of us are still around.
I see.
Wasn't that the same organization that Chuck Furutani became involved
right.
with? Yeah. It was through his...
And his son's now the board member of LA Unified School.
Yeah, I recognize the name when you said that.
Yeah, Warren.
Yeah. So Warren is very familiar with the Foisia family.
I see.
And because, you know, through his father who used to work
with
that group.
But outside of the church activities, that I'm Catholic and then Protestant, on a social level also we dealt with the Samoan Federation 404 mm-hmm. for the longest time. That's where everything was centered.
Mm-hmm.
And we happened to work with those programs for county. But it was also always with the Asian community.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, Office of Samoan Affairs, we're just involved in there as citizens,
mm-hmm.
concerned citizens, but at the other organization, we all do individually.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We've kind of branched out, not just one ethnic group, but trying to work with other groups. So,
mm-hmm.
so.
And we support those candidates that we believe can further the identity of our culture and our
mm-hmm.
people.
It's sort of a hard question, but what would you say are the things that you're trying, that you feel that you're trying to express that you need to, in terms of politically that you were talking about earlier, what are the sorts of issues?
Representation, first of all, we definitely need to educate our youth that they need to become aware and get into those offices that can, make policy changes, stop the injustice on many issues.
Mm-hmm.
And also not target so much other areas that neglect us. Right now, I believe we do have our youth, the dropout percentage is very low among all ethnic groups,
mm-hmm.
and we need to strengthen that. And unfortunately, it's unfortunately it's not working because the percentages are still very low. And I guess to seek higher education.
Mm-hmm. Which is the stuff that you've been working on for today.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about some of that, the things that
you're involved with? Well, basically, like, what Kale was saying, I mean, obviously these guys here were, very politically aware back then in the 70s. And, to me that's fascinating when I hear them talk about it because, in contrast back in New Zealand, there was never such an awareness like that in New Zealand. There was never any... attempts to try and understand our culture or something. I mean, we were just all lumped as Pacific Islanders, and we were all kind of like under the European people. And it was like we just did whatever, the European dictated, more or less. And it was just, oh gosh, I think it was the 80s, huh?
Mm-hmm.
That's when the Samoans... They're like the dominant group, the Polynesian group in New Zealand, and they're the ones that first broke away and started a political movement there. And as a result of their efforts in New Zealand, we now have our Samoan language being taught in high schools and is part of the university curriculum.
But the catalyst to that was the black movement here in the United States.
Yeah, we had students that would come to visit me here. Remember those kids? And we would sit around the table and talk, and these were very active kids, university kids back there. And after hearing him talk and telling him about his experiences growing up, I mean, it was just like a big revelation to them. And they were part of that movement that went back. Remember my girlfriend Atsa? Mm-hmm. Her brother and sister was the one that led the protest march against the New Zealand government.
Was it a Black Panther group?
Yeah. And they led the march against the New Zealand government to get the Maori land back.
American, African Americans went to New Zealand?
No.
Or your
Samoans took
up friends.
Your influence
the tactics of, mm-hmm. of the Black Americans.
Yeah, very interesting. I was shocked. I read it in the newspaper.
They even took the name Black Panthers.
Yeah. So that's why I'm saying it's fascinating to me when I hear them, because their movement was, you know, way back. Mm-hmm. And so when I think I first became really interested and motivated politically, when we had an issue that was in front of the city council. And that's just recent. That was just a few years ago. And it involved Harry, Kia's husband, Junior's brother. And I was just so, you know, just so fascinated about how things evolve, you know, that can evolve politically from a simple issue. And then I became to understand more, because I really didn't understand how politics work. I really wasn't understanding or was aware, you know, of the injustices that our people go through.
Well,
you know, we're an invisible minority here.
Can I ask what the issue was?
It was the renaming of Scott Park.
The park that we all hang out at.
To the Harry T. Foisier Memorial Park. It was a movement, it was an issue that was brought about, ironically, by some friends from the city. And they had asked her if she would support him, you know, and she just said, well, you know, whatever you guys want to do. And we just took it over, more or less.
But one more thing, it's the influence of the African-American community. There are already three parks named after African-American private citizens like my husband. Mm-hmm. Therefore, well, why, everybody said, why not? Why can't the Samoans, right, who have been here for years, ask for that? And, of course, we went, mm-hmm. and the obstinate person in the council was Mayor Matoma, who was of mm-hmm. Japanese descent. So here we are, Pacific Islanders, facing what we thought would be an insensitive person to represent us and our ideas, and unfortunately he took another route.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been, the Human Relations Commission also agreed, mm-hmm. but unfortunately, like we said, politics got in the way,
mm-hmm.
and it's now sitting in the back burner.
I just jumped in just as a sister, as a relative, as a sister-in-law, to lend support to the you know, to the people,
mm-hmm.
that wanted to make this request, and gosh, then all of a sudden it just turned into this big, you know, blowing up movement.
But the sad part of it all is that while this was somewhat positive, two other issues had already started up that negatively impacted the whole situation. That was the beating of the Dole family in Cerritos a year before that. And that went to Sheriff Block, and they were going through legal proceedings. At the same time, the shooting or the killing of the two brothers, the Tualalay brothers. So we thought that our issue was just something more, you know, on a social community level. It shouldn't have been something, you know, negative. Unfortunately, it got wrapped up between all of this injustice, mm-hmm. and that's where it sits now, just waiting to see what type of representation to understand mm-hmm. our plight and how many years we've been here,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't get any support from the NAACP at the time, because that was a friend of the mayor,
mm-hmm.
you know, so it's all interwoven, the politics,
true.
As we see it.
That's when we realize that the power of the vote is mm-hmm. worth it.
And we have no clout.
And you know, the sad thing about it, you know, from my point of view, you know, not even being politically aware in New Zealand, like I said, and then coming here and seeing everything going around and stuff, you know, I came to find out through this issue that the church property that his dad was, you know, the minister of, they used to open their doors to, what you call, different programs that the city ran.
Mm-hmm.
You know, senior citizen programs, youth summer programs, they used to hold it there at the church land. So, I mean, the family has been active, you know, not only, you know, socially,
mm-hmm.
but also, if you really look at it, somehow politically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I'm going, gee, it's amazing that because we don't have a voice, so to speak, you know, as a people, as a Samoan people, it's like, you know, we're invisible.
Right.
So I guess that's when I really became active, and it's only very recent. And then I, you know, jumped on board as far as trying to get our kids to, you know, be more aware of their power through education, mm-hmm. and joined the Association of Pacific Island Educators. Mm-hmm. And we've been in this organization now for, 7 years? So, you know.
In terms of your ethnic background now, which is not non-political, of course, it's always a big part mm-hmm. of it, what sorts of things do you think it's important to maintain for the next generation or pass on to them that has to do with, since you none of you were born in the States, what about that other culture?
Passing it on?
Yeah.
Well, I think what stuck us together was that our parents always stressed family. And that's what we try to pass on to the kids, is we are family, and we can trace our family back to the beginning. Mm-hmm. Because my father always told me that's what's wrong with Americans, is they don't know how far back their family goes. They're going to go so far, and that's it. And my father says he can trace his family back to the first one that landed on the island. And that's what he tries to pass on to us, and that's what we have to pass on to our kids, is that family is what it's all about.
That, yes, I agree with him. And also, we have a lot of customs, and we have a Matai system that upholds the chief, that's head of the household of the family. Now, we agree with that also, but we believe that it needs to be somewhat amended or in a way that it can deal with what's going on today. We trust our chiefs, but we believe that, like all systems, they can be abused. And we have, of course, our respect for our reverend and our, you see many Samoan churches here. We identify with our culture and our customs, and it's important that the children know, but also to somewhat adapt with the modern culture or modern civilization, as we call it, and to realize that that's what holds us together, that's what makes us unique. Mm-hmm. But we need to deal with it in a way that's going to promote the youth and our people and not create a hardship in many senses. The chiefs are good, and they need to teach the language. That's why we can't lose it. But other than that, I think the love of our homeland and what the stories our parents have told us. Mm-hmm. I watched the Joy Luck Club the other day, and I think that was remarkable, how the different stories of the mothers and the hardships they endured. You begin to wonder just exactly what our mothers went through, and I respect that, that it was the stories anyway. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very moving. Mm-hmm. I saw a lot of women crying in the theater, but the what they went through, I think about how my mother endured, not knowing what she was coming to, and I'm supposed to be a better person for it, and I hope I am, but we need to teach that to our younger, children.
Hmm. No, well, along the same lines as Junior and Cam, family, culture, and church. These are three things that has always been stressed, in my family growing up. And coming here to the States now, I believe that those are the three things that we always stress to our kids, that as a family we have to, be supportive of each other, and we have to stay together, and we have to respect, our roles in the family. We stress, the elders, going on down the line, that the youngest can't disrespect the elders, and we stress respect for the parents, respect for our elder family members, and respect for those in authority, and especially church. That's a very strong factor. Your family just automatically carries on over to your church. The minister there is like, the head also of your family. If you have any problems, your minister is there. But then also, like Kia said, we have this Matai, or this chief system in place, in our culture, and that's very important. But like she said, when you're living here in America, you just have to, our chiefs have to understand that sometimes it's difficult for us to, to be 100% in that way, in that chief, system. So we have to try. And her husband was very much for this type of thinking, that we have to adjust somehow so that it's easier on us, because our true culture, or the Fa-Samoa, is very, very hard to follow here in America.
It's very strict.
Very strict.
Was there a chief or head of the Foisea family?
Yes.
Her husband. Yeah, he took the title.
How does one take it? Does it get bestowed upon you?
Yes, it gets bestowed. The chief, you know, the older chief of the family, mm-hmm. Will put in his recommendation, and to the other chiefs and the heads of the family. And then if they all agree, then that's who will take the title. So it was all agreed upon that Harry will take the title, or one of the children of Foisea, uh-huh. You know. And the brothers and sisters, you know, wanted Harry to take it because he, as you know, he's always sneaking out. You know, he's admitted it himself. It's on tape.
A bit Americanized.
Yeah, very Americanized.
The American chief.
Yeah. But Harry was very, very strong in the culture, and, you know, and he took the challenge. He rose to meet the challenge, and he did a great job.
It was unfortunate because I was at the mother's request, and both parents did not live to see this happen.
They didn't.
That's why it meant so much for the children. Mm-hmm. You know.
Well, he went through the whole works. He went back to the islands and went through the whole ceremony, which is something that, you know, not too many people go through. You know, you may take a title, you may take it, you may have the chiefs come from the islands here, and they will do the same, but it's not a, you know, it's not the full thing, it's not the real thing, you know. Or they may even go back to the islands and just, you know, bestow it, and then you register your name, you know, but you don't go through the whole ceremony.
Did you all go out to Samoa when you went for the ceremony?
The sisters went.
Yeah, the sisters, some of my brothers.
The younger one, yeah, not us.
Yeah. Two These two think alike, very much alike.
No, not so much.
Oh, I don't know about that, Kim. Yeah, but
our chiefs are, we take very seriously in social functions and during family functions. That's correct. Huh? Whatever they say usually goes.
Right.
And we have a regular high chief and a high talking chief.
Right.
So that's part of the culture that the children grow up in. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And our children know that. I mean, I'm very proud of the fact that our children, who were born and raised here now, they're very, very strong in the culture. You know, and they really respect that. So I'm very proud of that, because I don't know about the other Samoan kids. That's something that, as a group, you know, we want to see.
Well, just recently, our son, who's 19,
mm-hmm.
he just volunteered to go back to the island and stay with my uncle. So he's really good. My uncle says that by the time he comes back, he should be well-versed in the language
the custom.
and customs. Because when they speak, there's different words they use. It's not the everyday words.
There's an everyday language and the formal language that is spoken by the chiefs only and the elders and the ministers. So when you're in a formal gathering, you don't speak your regular language because it's very rude. So you have to know the correct way to address and the proper language to use.
And by the chief's name or title, it also mm-hmm. recognizes your village and family, no matter where you're at.
And your status.
And your status.
Whether you're a high chief or a small chief.
that's just a known fact, you know, in any function. When you identify your chief or that's your family name, they know who you are, what village you come from,
mm-hmm.
you know, how long that chief status has been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess if we can, just to wrap up, if any of the photos, that if you thought about any of the photos that you had donated to the library, what among them are ones that have sort of very special meaning to you or experiences attached to them?
Yeah. You want to go first? The ones that I ticked, I think those are the ones you should.
The ones you ticked off. Mm-hmm.
And if you could talk a little about that. I do want to look at some of these. Yeah, these are the ones I was able to copy of yours.
Well, off the bat, right off the top, after watching Joy Club, this is special to me. It was my mother and I think I was 2 years old. We were going to get ready to take that trip on the USS Jackson to come to Hawaii. But my mother went through a lot, and she lost her parents at a young age. And so just the hardship that she endured, and not with a limited education, and being brave enough to, you know, try to speak English and learn everything. Yeah, this one right here is special.
What did your mother do when she came to the States? Was she working?
Oh, no, she was just a regular housewife in the Navy. And she had her run-ins with the neighborhood.
With what?
Oh, some of the ladies, you know, because my father was an enlisted man, would give her a hard time because they felt that, you know, they were above her. So she would always have to go in there and ask questions on how to fill out forms and all that. And she always said, you know, when you get grow up and get educated, you're going to do all these things for me. And which I did, you know, eventually fill out these forms for her. But, you know, this is really special, this one. Oh, and of course, you know, when my mother became Americanized, she insisted that we always dress up. This was in the 50s. I mean, I got tired of wearing hats to church. And she, it was so bad when we came here in 64, we were going to go to Disneyland, she made us dress up. Here we were all mad, we were walking around, you know, in our Sunday best, while everyone else was in shorts. And she goes, because we're in America, you know. But that's how she was that type of person, you know, she wanted so much to fit in and, you know, be respected in that manner. Yeah, so, it, you know, I had really enjoyed that, joy look.
I liked it too.
Yeah, I saw it. Mm-hmm. So this photo you'll see in the book because, you know, it's my husband receiving an award from the city council as part of all these politics. But we brought that for you because it's interesting. It was the first time that the publisher went through that route. And we talked about the Shades of L.A.
Oh,
yes,
yeah,
we
sure did.
You told them. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me about what your husband, the work your husband was doing? It's very important.
See, at the time he was a code enforcement and security manager for the city of Carson, and that was the public safety department, mm-hmm. and he was head of all the enforcement of the municipal codes, hazardous waste material, security functions for the dignitaries, mm-hmm. things like that.
And then he was involved in other sort of more social...
Oh, yeah. Like we mentioned with him earlier, Omai Fatasi, talking with the kids, telling mm-hmm. them that they can turn their lives around and get more serious, you know, that things are happening in the world instead of just being out in the streets and partying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, he was really into the youth, mm-hmm. really. I mean, it seemed like he was driven to keep these kids off the street. It seems mm-hmm. like that was his whole focus, you know, to keep these kids in school, mm-hmm. get them off the streets, and, you know, get into something positive, you know. I mean, he was also, on the board of Boys and Girls Club mm-hmm. when that first... came here into the city of Carson.
I guess he learned through his experience and wanted, I guess it almost like he would jump into a kid's mind and say, hey, mm-hmm. I know where you're at.
Yeah.
You know, I really know where you're at. And, you know, kids are now, you don't understand anything. No, he understood. Sometimes he would have to counsel kids and actually tell them, you know, don't be afraid to express yourself. If there's something you want to say, say it. Mm-hmm. But if you don't, and you just keep it within, it's not going to help anyone, especially yourself. Mm-hmm. So I think it's more from his experience, and he wanted to teach that. You know, say you can rise above, you know, your self-doubts, mm-hmm. like he did, you know, more or less. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he got involved in the scholarship mm-hmm. organization also.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, and he was very much into church and... You know, I mean, I think everything that we've discussed here, he was right. very much a part of that.
But of course, we give credit to a lot of the, what we call the brotherhood, like his older brother here, and then several other, I guess like Ali, he was the Reverend's son that from the Double Street Church, Big John. They were all a brotherhood that wanted to promote and, you know, keep our culture intact. That's what made us separate and different from everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
So we, you know, they were all together.
That's right. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's so true because, I mean, there are a lot of other Samoans that came, you know, around the same time or after. And what Kia says is, you know, very true. I think that's what distinguished, you know, themselves and then also me, very recent, mm-hmm. is because we're just very strong, you know, in our beliefs that we have to promote our people.
Mm-hmm.
We have to make them aware, you know, of our identity and what we can do as a people,
mm-hmm.
you know. And the rest of our community are not like that, you know. And so, yeah,
that's
they
the
look
struggle.
At us. Yeah, that's our struggle now,
mm-hmm.
you know. And fortunately, a lot of them are beginning to come on board and give us support. And we're very, very, you know, happy with that. A lot of these organizations around, they will involve us now, and a lot of the activities will call us up and, you know, ask for our support. So, you know, I think that's a big step forward.
Sure.
Yeah. We even have a Samoan that's running for
State Senate.
Yeah, so, you know, we're very supportive, and we've been very active in helping him with this campaign. So I think we've made some, you know, big steps forward as far as, you know.
Just that crab syndrome where, as these crabs are in the pot trying to climb up, some are dragging them down. I've heard a lot of other Asian groups mention that. Recently some Filipino community, but they are really moving fast in Carson. In politics and business.
We're
still behind.
When did you notice that it had grown, the community had gotten bigger? Like, when did most, I don't know, was it just gradual?
The Filipino community?
No,
the Samoans. I think it's by the churches. Huh?
I noticed that in 1966. Uh-huh. Because I left here in 1963, and there were very few Samoans here. When I came back in 1966, I was surprised. I went into the market, and I saw more than five of them in one place at one time. And that really blew me away that time. And then when I went to church, and I saw, gosh, the church has grown.
Yeah.
That's when you really know it.
Yeah.
And there wasn't only just one church now. There was just a whole bunch more who sprung up.
I think it's through the churches mainly.
That's right.
Mainly through the churches.
Their main, how fast they can obtain land, fundraisers, and just like that, we can